squares, and anything else they were directed to do by the barrels of the rifles pointed at them. Jack and Sands took their time, working their way around the periphery, as far away from the light as possible. The sound of the ceaseless rain and the rumbling diesel covered their tracks, but the cold air turned their breath into steaming vapor. They caught the first guard by himself taking a leak. Sands seized him by the skull and twisted. The man's neck broke with a muffled crack. His partner was next, taken down by the butt of Jack's rifle to the back of his head, and then Sands's knife across his throat. The two of them dashed across the compound, where Clouzet and the last guard hovered over a group of miners filling sacks with processed material. Sands fired his Beretta, putting 2 9-millimeter rounds in the guard's forehead. "Don't even think about it," Jack said as the Frenchman reached for his pistol. Clouzet's tattooed hand froze in place. He smiled as Jack and Sands stepped into the light, Jack's rifle and Sands's pistol both pointed at him. "You want to fill in the details?" Jack asked, grabbing Clouzet's pistol from its holster. "I'm a working man, hired to do a job, that's all. And killing innocent people is part of the job description. Who is innocent in this godforsaken world? Nobody gets out of here alive anyway." "Great. A fucking philosopher," Sands said. Clouzet turned to Sands. "I didn't think you had any game left in you. Tonight truly is full of surprises." He grinned widely. Sands's pistol cracked. The Frenchman's head snapped backward, the smile still plastered to his face. He toppled over, splashing into the mud on the flat of his back, his arms flung wide. "We could have questioned him."
"Yeah, we could have," Sands agreed, holstering his weapon.
"Now can we go?"
"What about them?"
Jack nodded around the camp. The miners had dropped to the ground or crouched behind equipment, terrified when they heard the gunshots. Sands sighed.
"Let's get these people organized. See if you can find a sat phone or a radio in one of those trailers while I go talk to them."
Sands stomped off toward a knot of miners, speaking Spanish in a friendly, comforting manner. Jack had other business first. He stepped over to Clouzet and snatched Corey's amulet off the lifeless neck. He still had a promise to keep. Chapter 81. Jack drank enough water from the storage tank to fill an aquarium, or so it seemed, before heading over to the undamaged office trailer, where he found a fully charged sat phone. A call to Jerry set everything in motion, including notifying the president. Jack and Sands spent the next hour caring for the miners, first by getting them out of the rain and cramming them into the remaining bunkhouse trailers where the guards had been. Sands managed to fire up the heaters while Jack distributed warm blankets and spare dry clothing. Sands learned in Spanish that all of these people were taken from clinics in Lima, La Paz, and a few other cities. These drug addicts, alcoholics, and prostitutes were all given promises of a brighter future and worthwhile employment until they arrived at La Hermana, starved, beaten, and in the case of the women, raped repeatedly. They had no recourse but to work or die digging. As society's castoffs, no officials bothered searching for them. The rain stopped just before dawn as the first of two MH-60R Seahawk Romeo helicopters roared into view, flown in from the flight deck of the Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser Bella Wood, CG-74, docked at Lima's naval port as part of a Latin American show-the-flag mission for the 4th Fleet. The helicopters were normally fitted out with anti-submarine gear and weapons. Because the choppers had to fly beyond their rated altitudes, only volunteers were allowed on the op. The captain ordered the ordnance stripped and the two ASW air crewmen debarked. A half dozen Spanish-speaking Marines and Navy corpsmen crammed into each aircraft with medical supplies, blankets, and MREs.
"I've got orders from the CMC directly to load you onto my chopper, sir,"
the Marine lieutenant shouted over the idling turbines on the windswept plateau. Jack shrugged.
"Sorry, Lieutenant. My dad was in the Corps, not me. You can tell the Commandant I'm not moving off this mountain until those people get their ride first."
"He said you'd say something like that."
The lieutenant smiled. His lance corporal tapped the Stinger missile on his shoulder.
We'll sit tight until the Peruvian Air Force arrives. But if the Halo or Cayuse you reported show up, Corporal Hernandez will send them a high-explosive greeting card.
I'll hold you to that, Jack said. Until then, I'm going to find me a cup of coffee.
An hour later, the first silver rays of the sun pierced the low-lying clouds. Best sunrise I've ever seen, Jack thought, mostly because he didn't think he'd live to see it. Jack stood at the place Corey's father had been so many years before. He opened the small wooden amulet and said a silent prayer as the light breeze scattered the half ounce of Corey's ashes over the granite rocks below, then knelt down and buried the crumpled photo in the wet dirt. Behind him, twin GE turboshafts roared as the Peruvian Air Force SH-3 Sea King helicopter lifted off, carrying the last of the miners off the mountain. Sands and the Marine lieutenant approached.
"Does that satisfy you, Mr. Ryan?" the lieutenant asked, hopefully. "My ass is already in a sling."
"I'm ready to roll if you are." "Hey, question. You bring a cell phone with you?"
"Yes, sir."
"Why?" He handed it to Jack. "I've got some pics I need to snap. I'll bring it right back. 5 minutes tops."
The lieutenant nodded as he stepped away, calling up one of the Seahawks circling overhead to prepare to pick up Hammer, Jack's code name.
"You did good," Sans said.
"Not good enough, but it'll have to do."
They stood on the edge of the plateau. Cielo Santo was a dirty smudge far down below.
"We'll head back down there and grab your stuff. Then we'll catch my plane in Lima back to the States."
"No, but thanks."
Sans pointed back down the mountain toward Cielo Santo.
"I'm gonna make my stand down there. Maybe help turn things around for those poor folks."
Jack understood. Sans had filled him in on a few details in the last hour. The former Ranger's personal descent into hell began years ago when an Iraqi translator and his family he had recruited were brutally tortured and killed before Sans could get them out of the country. He had blamed himself for breaking faith with the family he'd promised to protect. Their murders broke him. No longer caring about anything, especially himself, he drifted around until he washed up at Cielo Santo. Sans told Jack he knew bad actors were up on La Hermana Alta, but he swore he didn't know about the specifics. "Mostly because I didn't give a shit," he'd admitted, shame cracking his voice. Seeing Jack reminded him of his younger self, and Jack's determination to keep faith on a promise to a dead friend rekindled something deep inside he'd thought he'd lost.
"I owe you one," Sans said.
"Other way around, I think."
Jack nodded toward Cielo Santo.
"Won't be easy.
Nothing good ever is.
But you can do me one favor.
Name it.
Tell Midas that Brick still has a few rounds left in the chamber. Will ya?"
Chapter 82. On board the Hendley Associates G550. Beyond logistics and scheduling, Lizanne Robertson was responsible for campus crew and aircraft security, a skill set she acquired on tours of duty with both the Marine Corps and the City of Alexandria Police Department. But as good as she was to have in a fight, she also knew her way around a galley. While Jack showered in the Gulfstream's small but adequate bathroom and changed into fresh clothes, Lizanne began preparing the waffles, bacon, and eggs he'd requested. Remembering Clark's visit to his apartment a few days ago, which his aching body told him was more like a few years ago, the first call Jack made was to his dad on his private number, assuring the old man that he was tired but fine and would be back in the States that very evening. The second call he made was to Gavin Beery, the campus's IT genius.
"You get those photos I sent you?"
Jack asked. He'd used the Marine Lieutenant's phone to grab pics of the dead French merc, along with a Foreign Legion paratrooper tattoo on his hand, and forwarded them to Beery.
"Sure did. Helped me narrow down my search results from 327 to just 2, both ending in the name Clouzet. And your hunch was right. They're brothers, separated by 11 months.
I know one of them is in a metal drawer in a Lima morgue right now. Where's the other, Uncule?" Still working on it. I've got a few databases I'm about to raid. I should have an answer by the time you get back to the office. Jack thanked Gavin for working his digital magic once again and rang off. Lisanne arrived at his seat with plates of steaming hot food and cold, fresh-squeezed orange juice. But Jack had already passed out and was snoring like a bandsaw. She set the tray down, covered him with a blanket, and sat in the seat across from him, keeping a careful watch over her exhausted passenger. San Francisco, California. The CloudServe Bombardier Global 8000 lifted off at 5 p.m. PST. Capable of carrying up to 17 passengers, today's flight included just Elias Dahm and Amanda Watson, along with the flight crew. From San Francisco, they could reach Sydney or Moscow without refueling, but a flight plan was filed for London Heathrow, arriving by noon local tomorrow, just in time for the Tech World Conference kickoff. Watson was grateful for the Bombardier's separate en-suite arrangements. Elias had already retreated to his cabin, presumably to write his speech. He had arrived at the charter terminal in a strange and irritable mood, barely greeting her or the crew, as was his habit. She assumed he was still brooding over the French Guiana disaster, but his moods were as hard to read as Kierkegaard. It could have been far worse for him. Watson barely convinced Foley to keep the Fung matter between themselves, arguing that the fewer people who knew about it, the better. She promised Foley she'd inform him immediately after the conference, a delay of just a few days. And frankly, Mary Pat, I need Elias focused on London. It's our most important annual event. This news will send him over the edge. Foley understood her concerns and reluctantly agreed, but only because Watson had been responsible for first finding Fung. I want you both in my office the day you get back from London. We'll be there. You have my word. Watson was relieved Dahm had sequestered himself away for the long plane ride. After dinner, she would finish up her final notes for Foley and turn in. Given the events of the past few days, she could use a good night's sleep, and she needed to be fully rested for the world's most important industry conference. She had a feeling London was going to be eventful for them both. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack sure as hell didn't feel like one. But Clark and the rest of the campus operators, Ding, Dahm, Midas, Adara, and Gavin, greeted him at the Hindley Associates charter hangar like a returning hometown hero, with smiles and hugs and claps on the back all around. The campus had been briefed about the events of the previous 24 hours, including the successful evacuation and hospitalization of all 42 minors from La Hermana Alta. Clark noticed a marked difference in young Ryan since their last conversation. Quiet, but in good spirits. Apparently Jack had taken a good look in that mirror they had talked about back at his apartment, and he must have fixed whatever he had seen down in Peru. Any line on Cluse? Jack asked Gavin, who was munching on a jumbo-sized Snickers bar. Yes, as a matter of fact. That Iron Syndicate outfit that was hunting you last year? The one Clark told me to keep an eye on? Well, I found an Interpol internal memorandum linking the Cluse brothers to it, thanks to those funky tattoos. So I take it you contacted Interpol for a line on him. Clark answered, we talked about it. But the Iron Syndicate is global. They've got agents and informants planted in every major security agency. It's better if we go after Cluse ourselves and maybe build a case that helps unravel the organization while we're at it. Jack had read the 2018 DNI Worldwide Threat Assessment. It listed organized crime, a $2 trillion global enterprise, as a serious American national security threat. He wanted Cluse dead, but he was all for taking down the Iron Syndicate in the process, if at all possible. If we're not going to Interpol, our only shot at finding Cluse is the Czech. That's exactly why we're here, Clark said. Where is he now?
At home, in Czechia.
He's making it kinda easy, isn't he? Jack asked. A dog always returns to his vomit, the Bible says, Gavin offered, wiping the chocolate from his lips. And you don't trust the Czech government to round him up for us either, I take it.
I think it'll be better if we talk to him ourselves.
I'd hate for the old fart to accidentally get a bullet in the face and his secrets die with him because we tipped off the wrong person.
Then let's go talk to him.
We're already planning on it. You want in?
Do you have to ask?
It involves another long plane ride.
I can use the miles.
Are you 100%?
This thing might get a little hairy.
Jack's eyes narrowed.
Don't even think about cutting me out of this.
Clark recognized the determination in his eyes. He also understood it. He had the same fire in his belly when he reaped bloody vengeance for Pamela Madden's murder 4 decades ago. Clark threw a thumb over his shoulder. A stack of mission gear stood in the corner of the hangar. Something serious was about to go down.
Brought your kid along just in case.
We're saddling up right now. Wheels up as soon as the plane is gassed and the pre-flight completed. I'll brief you on the ride over.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
You earned it, kid. You did a heck of a job down there. Heads nodded all around.
No,
Jack said. The job just got started. Now it's time to finish it. Chapter 83. Washington, D.C. Case closed. Fortson at Q Group had signed off, as had the IT division heads from each of the IC departments. So had Watson. Foley sighed with relief. The intelligence community had dodged a bullet. No, an artillery shell. For a terrifying moment, she envisioned shutting down the entire IC cloud, currently processing more than 1,000 terabytes of video and audio surveillance data each day, and trillions of pieces of metadata from phone and computer records from around the world. Intelligence collection and processing, as it was currently practiced, would have ground to a halt. The damage to American intelligence credibility would have been devastating, perhaps insurmountable. No ally would ever trust the United States again. Fortunately, the leak was cauterized. Fung had been the lone perpetrator, and his breach had been severely limited in scope and time. The forensics on his laptop had been completed and confirmed Fortson's initial conclusion. Watson immediately and secretly patched Fung's breach with the CIA comms satellite. She then helped design a secret emergency security audit, searching desperately for any other signs of a breach in the IC cloud. If some other party had broken in and saw what they were up to, they'd go to ground. The bigger challenge was to keep the IC cloud humming along while the investigation was going on. Too many other critical real-time projects were at stake, and even the hint of a possibility of a breach would have put their allies, particularly the Five Eyes members, in a panic. Foley was grateful for Watson's Herculean efforts. Judging by the timestamps on her calls, texts, and emails, Watson had worked around the clock for the last 48 hours. Now she was off to a conference in London, but promised to be available 24/7 should any need arise. Watson and the experts all agreed that Fung's breach had been something of a fluke and not indicative of a larger security problem. Fully worried about Watson, she had taken the news about Fung's espionage particularly hard and counted it as both a personal and professional failure. In a sense, she was right on both counts. But Foley was equally culpable. It had all happened on her watch. The most obvious question that plagued her was how had Fung managed to evade the regular security audits of critical IC contracting personnel? Were they not being conducted as often and as thoroughly as she assumed? Or relying too heavily on polygraph testing, easily defeated by proper coaching? She would need to address the issue as soon as the dust settled. Now all that was left was for Foley to put together an executive summary of the Fung incident and call the president. As a former national security advisor and deputy director of Central Intelligence, he would appreciate both the severity of the crisis and its rapid resolution. As POTUS, she imagined he would be furious. But Foley didn't believe in hiding the dirty laundry, come what may. Sunshine was the best disinfectant, especially in her line of work. Klatovy District, Plzeňa Region, Czechia, formerly known as the Czech Republic.
The barrel of Clark's Colt 45 pressed against the Czech's knee as he sat in his favorite high-backed office chair. Like the rest of his massive hunting lodge, the log walls featured trophies of game he had killed in the surrounding forest.
"Really, Mr. Clark? Such dramatics. Last chance, buddy. If you ever want to dance the cha-cha again, you better tell me where we can find Cluse."
Jack was in the room as well, Glock 19 in hand, along with Gavin, who was already rooting around the gangster's laptop.
"We've both seen this movie before. If I tell you, you'll kill me anyway."
Jack said, "We just want Cluse, not you."
"Is that what you told my guards outside before you killed them too?"
"They didn't cooperate. That made them collateral damage. Now it's your turn to choose," Jack said. The owlish eyes behind the glasses studied Jack's face.
"Cluse has wronged you personally, hasn't he?"
Jack charged forward, gun up. He jammed the barrel against the Czech's skull, knocking his glasses off his nose. "Cluse, where is he?"
"Jack, last chance, asshole."
The Czech saw the murderous rage in Jack's eyes.
"I'm not a micromanager. I honestly have no idea."
"Then there's no reason for you to waste any more space on the planet." Jack's finger slid over to the trigger.
"No, wait. Perhaps I have something more valuable than Cluse to offer."
Clark pushed Jack's pistol away from the old man's forehead.
"Like what?" "Your country has a problem. A very large problem. A problem only I can resolve. But I will need to speak to Director Foley."
"You're out of your fucking mind," Jack said.
"Why Director Foley?" Clark asked. "Trust me. She will want to hear what I have to say."
Washington, D.C. Mary Pat Foley frowned with confusion when the Czech told her about the BKA agent murder in Berlin, that it was all based on intel provided to him by Chibi.
"I'm sorry to tell you this, but Chibi is dead. Killed himself. The leak has been sealed."
"It's not possible. My representative is meeting with him tomorrow. The confirmation came just an hour ago," the Czech said over the phone.
The blood drained from Foley's face. The Czech finished her thought for her.
"You were meant to believe the leak was sealed. Whatever corpse was conveniently provided to you was a ruse, and judging by the sound of your voice, a brilliant one."
15 minutes later, the Czech handed Clark's phone back to him with a triumphant smirk. "Mr. Clark, Mary Pat here. I'm afraid we're going to have to agree to his terms. Complete amnesty, in exchange for that algorithmic key."
"You trust him, ma'am?"
"Unfortunately, yes." His knowledge of the BKA murder was all the proof she needed. "Now what?"
"I need you to sit tight. I'm going to put you on a conference call.
I have an idea. I'll call you back in 20 minutes. Secure our friend in another room out of earshot. And don't hurt him."
"If you insist, ma'am."
The Czech sat back in his chair, satisfied he'd cheated death once again. Clark wanted to wipe the smile off the old man's face with the back of his hand. But he had his orders. He had to admit, though, the gangster had pulled a fast one. The Czech told Foley about a man named Chibi and a secret silent auction being held in London tomorrow night. One bid only, in person, by an authorized representative. The winning bidder would receive a special algorithmic key that would unlock the entire IC cloud. And the IC would never know about it. The Czech proposed that in exchange for his life, he would provide the encrypted passcode that allowed his representative to bid.
"They don't know who's coming. The only ID needed is the passcode."
Clark was no security expert, but Gavin's drop-jawed response told him it was all pretty serious.
"You know, if you screw us on this, you'll wish I'd let Jack blow your brains out," Clark said. I have no loyalties to anyone or anything other than to myself, Mr. Clark. My intense desire for self-preservation is your best guarantee.
Dom and Adara kept watch over the check in another room while Gavin, Clark, Jack, Mary Pat, and a couple NSA cyber wizards conferenced on Clark's phone. The plan they came up with was rough around the edges and more likely to fail than not. But it was their only shot. And it all depended on Gavin Beery.
Chapter 84. London, UK.
The Tech World Conference was held in a soaring glass tower hotel and convention center in the Canary Wharf section of London, adjacent to the River Thames. Gavin was dressed in a hastily acquired Savile Row suit. He sat in the back of a rental van with Clark and Adara. Midas was at the wheel. Dom and Ding were still in Czechia, keeping the old gangster under wraps until the mission was completed, after which he was free to leave. A decision Clark couldn't abide but didn't argue, because it wasn't his call to make. Jack and Foley were already in the hotel. Foley had flown a red-eye government jet with her hastily assembled team, arriving early that morning. "You're sweating buckets," Adara said, wiping Gavin's portly face with his handkerchief. "You might short out the microphone."
"Really?"
"Joking," Adara said. "You'll be fine." "Look, Gav, this is a cakewalk for a guy like you," Clark said, trying to calm the man down. "A tower full of computer geniuses jabbering about bits and bytes, and all the free cocktail weenies and soda pop you could ever want."
"But I'm not really a field operative."
"But you've always wanted to be one, and you've been out with us a bunch of times now."
"You'll do great," Adara reassured him. "But this is really, really important. I'm not IT support for the mission this time. I am the mission."
"And you'll kill it," Clark said. Gavin blanched. "Figuratively speaking, this is all IT stuff and IT people. No guns, no goons. Okay?"
"Okay."
"We'll have eyes on you the whole time," Adara said. She adjusted the tie clip with the embedded miniature video camera and microphone. "And no one more than one floor away." Clark checked his watch. "It's time." Gavin paced inside the hotel room the Czechs people had reserved for the conference, as per their instructions from Chibi. At precisely 8 p.m., Chibi's representative would arrive. Gavin would provide the Czechs' encrypted passcode to authenticate his false identity, and then hand over an envelope with the Czechs' bid. Gavin didn't care about the technical side of this meeting. That was as difficult as pulling $20 of cash out of an ATM. Playing it cool was the challenge, like he was actually the bad guy, and not some sweaty, fat techie play-acting like a spy. Gavin practiced his breathing exercises and tried to think about his favorite beach. When there was a knock at the door, he nearly fainted. "Come on, Gav. You can do this," he whispered to himself. He opened the door. He nearly wet himself.
Please, come in."
Chibi smiled and entered. Gavin shut the door. "Something wrong?"
"Wrong? No, not at all."
"You have something for me?"
"Yes."
He pulled out the Czech's thumb drive from his pants pocket and inserted it in the reader in Chibi's hand.
"Excellent.
And the bid?"
"The bid?
Sure." Gavin reached into his pocket and handed over the sealed envelope.
"I'll be in touch. Good luck."
Chibi turned to leave and pulled the door open. Mary Pat Foley stood in the doorway, furious. She slapped Amanda Watson hard across the face. "You treasonous bitch!"
Chapter 85. Foley, Clark, Jack, and Gavin stood over Watson, seated in a chair, her face still beet red from Foley's slap.
"When and where's the next meet?" Foley demanded. Watson checked her watch. 10 minutes from now. 2 floors up.
"How many more are left?"
"You got lucky. You were the first. 3 to go.
Here's the deal, short and sweet. You're going to do exactly as I say, and in exchange, I won't toss your ass off the 10th-story balcony myself. Does that work for you? You can't do that. Foley leaned on the chair, got right in her face. Just fucking try me. Watson blanched.
What do you want me to do?
Foley stood. Do exactly what you planned to do. Meet the other three, collect their bids. But then tell them this. The winner will receive a text tonight to come to a London location at a specified time, and that's when you'll hand over the algorithmic key. Are we clear?
Clear.
Foley called over her shoulder. Jack. Jack stepped over and wired Watson up with a Bluetooth ear device that doubled as a video audio unit. Jack touched his earpiece. Say something.
Something.
Jack nodded. Loud and clear. Foley said, if the mic and camera go dead, you're dead. Give us up, and you're dead. Do anything stupid and give yourself away. You're screaming in agony dead.
I won't screw it up. You'll see.
Yes, I will, Foley said. Now move your sorry ass. An hour and a half later, Watson was back in Gavin's room, seated in the same chair. The others were gathered around Gavin's laptop, scrubbing through Watson's first-person video. They'd seen it all live, but wanted to review just to be sure Watson hadn't pulled a fast one.
Well?
Watson asked.
You think you sold them?
Foley asked.
I sold you, didn't I?
Foley's jaw clenched.
Yeah, I guess you did. You sold a lot of us. I'm thirsty. Can I have a water or something?
Watson asked. Jack grabbed a bottle of water out of the mini-fridge and handed it to Watson. She cracked it open.
Why'd you do it?
Foley demanded.
Does it matter?
Watson took a swig.
Humor me. Multiple reasons.
Starting with?
First of all, because I could.
The idea of outsmarting the entire Western IC seemed like an immensely satisfying exercise.
Was it?
I mean, until we caught you red-handed.
Yes, entirely.
Foley turned to Clark. If I ask for your weapon, turn me down. Understood?
Yes, ma'am.
Why else? Foley demanded.
Elias Dom.
What about him?
While he was out banging teenage interns on his boat, I was building his goddamn company. Everybody knew Elias Dom. He was the rock star. I never got invited to an owner's box at the Super Bowl, or asked to toss out the first pitch at a Giants game, or hang out with Oprah in Maui. Instead, I got hit with questions all the time. Where's Elias? What's he like? Can you tell him hi for me? Can you tell him I'm a big fan? Made me want to puke.
You used to be in a relationship with him.
Yeah, for a while.
Talked me into walking away from my dream NSA job by offering me his bed. But then, after I got fenced in, he moved on to greener pastures.
You mean younger ones, Jack said.
You'd risk the security of the United States because your feelings got hurt? Clark asked.
Jack watched his face redden.
Why'd you stay around?
Foley asked.
The stock options, mostly.
I mean, CloudServe really was my company. I did most of the important work. Elias was just a salesman. Like I told you with Fung, Elias kept us all on a tight leash by keeping our stock options in escrow for 5 years after we left, in order to guarantee the NDAs and non-competes we signed. So if we left under bad terms, we couldn't earn a living and we'd lose everything we'd worked for.
Your stock options must have been worth tens of millions.
Try hundreds.
But doing this would kill the company, and your stocks would crash.
That's why I needed the auction. I could destroy the company and get rich, all at the same time.
Foley asked, any other reasons?
My brother.
The Ranger. Killed in the line of duty, Jack asked.
He was my hero. My life. And Ryan killed him.
How did the president kill your brother? Foley asked.
Watson's icy composure melted away. What the hell was my brother doing fighting in Ukraine? Or Afghanistan, Iraq, Niger, the Philippines? Her rage escalated. Why does Jack Ryan think America needs to fight everybody else's stupid wars? Wars that we caused to begin with? I'm sick of all the patriotic, flag-waving bullshit. It just gets good people killed. And for fucking what? Tell me why, goddammit!
Your brother was a soldier, Clark said. He swore an oath. He obeyed his orders. Maybe he didn't even agree with them. Hell, most of us in uniform don't agree with them, at least not all the time. But that's the job. And your brother did his job. He sacrificed his life for his country, a country you've betrayed.
Which means you betrayed his sacrifice, Jack added.
I still can't figure out why you decided to do the London meet yourself, Foley said. That was risky.
Watson slowed her breathing, fighting to regain her composure.
Trusting people is even riskier, isn't it? It was safer to do everything myself.
You didn't kill Fung.
No, I didn't.
But I'm guessing you had the job hired out. Probably the dark web, paid in Bitcoin so nothing could be traced back to you.
Watson smiled defiantly. Good luck proving that.
I won't bother trying. You did us a favor by hauling out the trash.
Gavin glanced up from the desk where he sat, the bid letters all opened.
Looks like the Iranians put in the highest bid.
Foley frowned.
Not the Chinese.
China was a close second, and Russia third.
The sanctions must have really put a hurt on old Yermolov, Clark said.
The Iranians obviously found other investors to sweeten the pot, Jack said, or sold a shit ton of weapons-grade uranium.
Foley turned to Watson. You would have turned over our national security apparatus to the Iranian mullahs.
Watson fought back a grin.
I was planning on giving all four of the bidders the algorithmic key. They would have been as busy screwing each other over as you guys.
And made a lot more money for you, Jack said, collecting all four bids.
Watson smiled defiantly. You're damn straight.
Eventually. They would have figured it out and come hunting for you, Foley said.
With the kind of money I would have made, good luck finding me.
She took another sip of water. Foley checked her watch and said to Clark, an hour before the Iranians arrive. We need to get moving. She said to Watson, we're going to wire you back up, so don't get cute.
As per Foley's instructions, each of the three bidders were texted that they had won the bid, and each was scheduled to arrive at a different time and a different location around London that Foley had prearranged. To protect Watson from kidnapping by a bidder too cheap to pay up, Clark would drive Watson to each location, using SDRs to avoid any chance of a tail, while the rest of the team would screen in two other cars for further protection. Foley also couldn't allow the three bidders to tail one another. She mobilized local CIA assets to ensure this didn't happen. Her plan would only work if each of them thought they had won the bid exclusively. Foley handed Watson three thumb drives. Each of these contain an algorithmic key that will give them limited access to a controlled area of the IC cloud. When they log on, they'll see they've purchased the real deal.
Let me guess. You've put something else on those drives.
When they connect to our cloud will connect to them. We're the ones who will gain unlimited access to their computer systems.
Cyber judo, Gavin said, chuckling. Pretty cool.
They'll figure out what you've done eventually, Watson said.
Not before we've raided their cookie jars.
So after I've held up my end of the bargain and pulled off this intelligence coup for you, what do I get out of all of this?
A traitor's noose, I hope, Clark said.
I doubt that will happen. Hanging women isn't very politically correct these days, Watson said, smirking.
There's an alternative solution that'll never make the papers, Clark said. Trust me on this.
Or you can take my offer, Foley said.
Which is?
You're not going to like it.
but it beats an early grave. Foley was right. Watson hated it. But she took it anyway.
Chapter 86. 300 miles due west of the Azores. Foley flew back to D.C. on the same Boeing C-40B jet she'd borrowed from the 89th Airlift Wing at Joint Base Andrews the day before. The C-40B was the military version of the 737-700 business jet, and like the president's much larger Air Force One, deployed secure data and comms for the 15 cyber warfare experts she brought on the flight over to London. Between them and the hastily assembled working group at the NSA, they had managed to build, test, and deploy the three algorithmic keys with the worm needed to carry off Foley's espionage coup: the penetration of the Chinese, Russian, and Iranian computer intelligence systems. The cyber warfare experts, men and women, mostly in their 20s and 30s, specialized in offensive cyber operations. Several were elite members of various armed forces cyber mission teams in joint service to U.S. Cyber Command. The only addition to the flight manifest was the new passenger, Amanda Watson, cuffed and secured by two of Foley's security detail. Watson tried to convince Foley that in 5 years, the knowledge she possessed would be utterly useless to foreign governments. Foley countered that high treason was a death penalty offense. Watson responded by describing in detail the secret portal she had carved into the IC cloud that her auctioned algorithmic key would open. She even patched it right there on the airplane under the supervision of Foley's top cyber warriors, who confirmed the fix. Foley's best and final offer was 30 years in a federal minimum security facility with community service privileges. She suggested it was still a better deal than a visit by John Clark in the middle of the night. Watson agreed. "Director Foley, you're not going to believe this," Sergeant Molly Houck said, the blue glow of the computer screen reflected in her glasses. Her baby bump hardly showed in her maternity battle uniform. "What is it?" The petite 23-year-old airman beamed. "We're already inside the Iranian mainframe." "They didn't waste any time, did they?" Foley said. She called over to the steward near the galley. "You guys got any champagne aboard this bird?" 250 miles due west of the Azores. The Hendley Associates G550 was on nearly the same flight path and just under 6 minutes behind Foley's aircraft. The campus team debriefed the events of the last few days, compared notes, and discussed options for future action. But it was difficult to lay out any specifics without hard data. Hard data that suddenly became available when Gavin shouted, "Crikey!" from the back of the aircraft near the galley. Hunkered over the Czech's laptop for the last 3 hours and connected to his own personally designed computer network via the onboard encrypted satellite comms, Gavin had unearthed a goldmine of data. "Hey, Jack, come over here and look at this. I think I've finally found an answer to that question you had." Jack scrambled back and dropped into the seat next to Gavin. He scrolled through pages of account numbers, deposits, and receipts. Jack clapped the IT director on his soft, round shoulder. "Gavin Beery, resident genius." Gavin beamed with pride. The two of them spent the remaining flight time assembling a document that would rock Capitol Hill like a high-magnitude quake. Chapter 87. Washington, D.C., Oval Office, the White House. "Mr. President," Senator Dixon said, flashing her best Chamber of Commerce luncheon smile. Dixon was a very attractive woman, President Ryan had noted on previous occasions, but her arrogance diminished it considerably for him. "Madam Senator, I appreciate you coming on such short notice." President Ryan gestured toward one of the chairs. She took one of the long Chesterfield couches instead. He didn't bother offering her anything to drink. "It must be urgent, Jack, so I came right over. I'm here to serve." "More like here to measure for curtains," Ryan thought. "Don't get too eager just yet." He took one of the chairs, a file folder in hand.
The seat gave him a slightly elevated position. Not that he needed it.
Where's your lapdog, Arnie? It won't be the same without him here, slavering on the leather and nipping at my heels.
We have a problem I'd like to discuss with you, and I wanted to do it in private.
Dixon pointed a finger at the ceiling.
We're not being recorded, then, I take it?
Never without asking permission, and I'm not asking for it. This stays strictly between us.
Dixon brightened. I'm all ears.
Ryan opened the file folder and handed her the inch-thick report. You'll find an executive summary on the first page. Dixon took the document in hand cautiously, her eyes locked on Ryan's.
Why don't you ballpark it for me? I know you're good at summarizing.
Ryan fought back a smile. His son Jack had already ballparked it for him less than an hour ago as his plane was landing. He and Gavin had put together one heck of a document, with every I dotted and every T crossed. He was damn proud of both of them. Bottom line, your son, Christopher Gage, stepson, has been connected with an international criminal organization known as the Iron Syndicate. He's also partnered with a Chinese national by the name of Hu Peng, the son of one of the directors of a state-owned bank and a high-ranking CCP official. The two of them have been running point for a drug smuggling operation distributing chemical precursors, along with processed heroin and methamphetamine all over Europe. They've hidden their activities behind a series of shell companies that take advantage of BRI trade treaties that Peng's father helped negotiate.
Dixon flipped a few pages, scanning numbers. That's a fascinating story. Sounds like a Clive Cussler novel. Even if it's true, what does it have to do with me?
I have no business or financial relationships with my stepson. If he's guilty of anything like you're describing, that's his problem, not mine. By the way, where is Christopher? We've reached out to him, but can't seem to locate him.
I have no idea. Like I said, his business affairs are his own, and no concern of mine.
Ryan sat back, tenting his fingers in front of a satisfied smile.
You put on a brave face, Deborah. I think we both know what kind of political damage this will do to your presidential run, even if you are legally innocent, which, in fact, you might be. This report screams swamp on every page, and you and your family are neck deep in it.
My husband's affairs are his own. I file a separate tax return from his and make it public every year, and have done so for the last 20 years. I have nothing to hide. My affairs are in order.
Then you might want to turn to page 37 of that report, where it begins to lay out the financial accounts of the Dixon Gage Charitable Trust, something I know you're very proud of.
Why shouldn't I be? We've done important work for poor and disadvantaged people all around the world, not to mention our brave veterans here at home, too.
And Christopher has been intimately involved with your charity, hasn't he?
Dixon stiffened. Yes, he has. For years. He's told me on more than one occasion that the work he's done there has changed his life.
I'm sure it has.
Meaning?
Unfortunately, Christopher was using your trust to launder his dirty money, making millions of dollars of annual contributions through thousands of fictitious donors.
I can't be responsible for the origin of anonymous monies donated.
No, but the story doesn't stop there. Christopher then funneled that dirty money into clean projects, especially ones in Africa, where there is very little government oversight, and where, coincidentally, the Peng family has significant resources invested. Christopher was buying charity goods and services at exorbitant prices from shell companies that he and Peng secretly owned. All of those water wells and tractors and schools you thought the trust was building all went instead into the pockets of your son and your husband, and it turns out, at least one high-ranking official in the Chinese Communist Party. Even if you can prove at trial you didn't know about any of this,
You're still going to be found guilty by association in the court of public opinion. And worse, it makes you look like an idiot or a dupe.
Dixon's heart rate fell. The arrogance around her Botoxed eyes faded away.
Not exactly a winning platform for a presidential campaign, Ryan said, just to twist the knife.
You'll have a hard time bringing any of this to court. I doubt it was legally obtained.
Nice bluff, Senator. Glad I never played poker with you.
I'm willing to take the chance, even if we lose in court, and my AG insists we won't. It will still ruin your reputation and take years to litigate. And we haven't even begun really digging yet. That report just scratches the surface.
Well, speaking of reputations, I have evidence of my own suggesting that your son Jack, Jerry Hendley, and, by implication, you, are associated with an organization engaged in questionable activities. I'll use my information to help launch impeachment proceedings against you.
The Chadwick stuff again. How'd that work out for her?
Chadwick is an idiot. I'm not, and you know it.
Ryan shrugged. Do your worst.
I'm not going to be president forever anyway.
A congressional investigation might determine that you and your associates are guilty of crimes for which you can be prosecuted.
In theory, yes, but I doubt it. But even if that were to happen, in theory, there could be a stack of pre-signed presidential pardons sitting in a safe somewhere, written up for just such a contingency.
Dixon's shoulders slumped, defeated. She stood, her voice softening.
Well then, there's nothing more to be said. I agree to resign from my office if you drop all of this nonsense.
On what grounds would you resign? Dixon smiled cynically.
To spend more time with my family, of course.
Isn't that what they always say?
Sit down, Deborah. We're not through yet.
His commanding voice dropped her back onto the couch.
It's high time we remind ourselves in this country that nobody is above the law, especially the people who write it. That's why I'm instructing the Attorney General to prosecute your family to the fullest extent of the law possible.
Jack, unless you agree to this.
Ryan stood, retrieved a bound document from his desk, and handed it to Dixon. He didn't bother to sit down.
What's this? Dixon said, opening it.
I'm sick and tired of the corruption that plagues this town. It's corroding the confidence of the American people in their government. Trust is the glue that holds a democracy together, and you people on the Hill are destroying that trust. Far too much legislation is passed that only benefits the few at the expense of the many.
What I just handed you is my proposed legislation to clean it all up. The sweetheart deals, the revolving doors, the family loopholes, all of it. Get this bill passed and on my desk in its present form for me to sign in the next 60 days, or I'll see you in court.
And if I get it done, then what?
Then I memory hole that report I handed you. And then you can resign to spend more time with your family. Whatever you decide to do after that is up to you.
Dixon smiled a little. You know, an anti-corruption bill like this would make a great presidential platform to run on.
Arnie was right, Ryan thought. Dixon was pure ambition, even in the face of disaster.
You may not be on Beijing's payroll, but you killed the Poland treaty because you're dancing to their tune. Was it all that Chinese money your husband made that flipped you? Or something else?
Money? Don't be ridiculous. What matters is something Sun Tzu called shi. Do you know the term?
Momentum, advantage, power.
Dixon shook her head, incredulous.
Always the professor. Then you also know that the world's changing, and China is the future.
My future is whatever we have the courage to make of it,
My job as president is to create change, not follow it. Dixon lifted the heavy file folder.
How do I know you still won't release that report after I get this legislation passed?
If everything in that report all came out, it might do more damage to the country than to you. And frankly, you're not worth it. More to the point, once you get that legislation passed, you have my word I won't use anything we discussed today to sabotage you or your family, as much as that idea sickens me. At that moment, Dixon hated Ryan's guts more than any person she had ever known. But she agreed to his terms. Because as much as she hated him, Dixon still knew that Jack Ryan was an old-fashioned patriot. And indeed, a man of his word.
Epilogue. Washington, D.C. With President Ryan's blessing and an executive order in hand, Foley put every available resource at her disposal into dismantling the Iron Syndicate, now deemed a high-priority national security threat. Within weeks, significant Iron Syndicate assets were uncovered and identified. Foley personally contacted the heads of the Chinese, Russian, and Iranian security agencies to provide them the names of the criminal elements within their respective governments, in order to stem the tide of illegal drugs and human trafficking around the world, she assured them. It was also a ploy to throw them off the scent of her recent espionage coup, perhaps the greatest in modern history. But the cancerous tendrils of the Iron Syndicate ran deep. Removing them proved difficult and painful. Investigators raced against Iron Syndicate bosses, desperate to cauterize leaks, cut away evidence, and tie off loose ends. Both President Ryan and Foley expected unintended consequences would follow. They did, sooner than they'd anticipated. San Francisco, California. The bankruptcy judge banged her gavel. CloudSurf, the most powerful cloud company on the planet, was dead. The circling vultures would soon divide the remains among themselves. The disappearance of Elias Dom had raised alarm bells all over Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C., though for entirely different reasons. Locals assumed Dom's disappearance was connected to the suicide of Lawrence Fung, whose troubled life and financial difficulties were detailed in a poignant expose that relied heavily on unnamed government sources. The locals were only half right. Despite Watson's fervent denials, the feds feared Dom was somehow connected to her plot and fled the country to avoid questioning, and worse, found asylum with one of America's strategic competitors. Foley suspected Dom was merely a coward, abandoning responsibility for his failed dreams. Weeks passed before a New Zealand widow sailing solo across the Pacific Ocean sighted the wreckage of Dom's yacht, Prometheus. Investigators concluded it had been swamped and broken apart by a recent tropical storm. His body was never recovered. Gdansk, Poland. The theme crew's pirate ship sailed slowly under engine power, with tourists on deck sipping hot mulled wine and shivering in the cool air. "What do you do with a drunken sailor?" blared in Polish over the loudspeakers. Two retired school teachers from Knoxville, Tennessee, stood on the forward deck, searching TripAdvisor on their smartphones for a seafood restaurant along the well-lit Motuava riverfront. Both of them felt the same thunk in the soles of their shoes as the pirate ship bumped into a heavy object in the water. The puffy-sleeved pirate crewman standing nearby shot them both a nervous glance, then leaned over the side to see what the ship had hit. An hour later, the police coroner's van hauled away the decomposed corpses of Christopher Gage and Hu Peng, bound together by ropes and drowned in the same canvas bag. Carpathian Mountains, Romania. The Czech stood on the edge of the forest, the pine-scented air crisp and cool in his nose, his favorite rifle in hand, his best dog at his side, and a guide's recent sighting of fat boar in the area promised a
perfect day. He hadn't been this happy in years. Retirement, though forced, had suited him, he decided. No more burdens of running a vast criminal enterprise. His Bohemian pointer began barking wildly, his bearded snout aimed at the stand of trees ahead of them in the far distance.
Rexy, good boy, what do you see?
The Czech heard the familiar crack, but didn't bother to move. In truth, he'd been expecting it for some time now. 200 grains of steel-jacketed lead split the mountain air some 600 meters distant. The bullet struck the Czech's forehead cleanly, but the back of his skull erupted in a gory cloud of blood, bone, and brain matter. His corpse tumbled into the tall grass, Rexy barking and whining at his feet. On the other side of the clearing, the Polish ABW sniper and his spotter slipped away, headed for their exfil point. Vodka would flow like tap water back at their barracks tonight. Foley had agreed to spare the Czech's life, but she never promised not to track him or convey his indirect responsibility for Liliana Pilecki's death to the Polish government. Liliana's actual killer remained unknown to the Poles, but not to Czech. Benghazi, Libya. News of his brother's death had only just reached him. Clouzet had been on the run for several weeks now. He was holed up in a fourth-floor apartment of a bombed-out six-story tenement building built with oil money by the Gaddafi regime decades ago. Gaddafi's death and the ensuing chaos transformed the richest country in Africa into an impoverished hellscape within a few short months, tortured and divided by rival Islamic factions, drug runners, and human trafficking syndicates. It was in the midst of this chaos and death that Clouzet finally found sanctuary and kindred spirits. With only intermittent water and electricity, his apartment was less of a home than a concrete cave, but useful for his current desperate circumstance, hunted by hostile governments and vengeful enemies alike. Its singular virtue was an unobstructed view of the Mediterranean on the far side of the coastal road. He got word out to a former Iron Syndicate colleague in the city, a gunrunner named Tot, that he was in town and available for the wet work Clouzet was famous for. Today, his friend would arrive within minutes, bearing good news, he promised. Broken glass crunched beneath Clouzet's boots as he stood in front of the shattered window overlooking the parking lot and the street beyond, careful to remain in the shadows. No telling who was lurking out there with a sniper rifle and a bullet with his name on it. A cool breeze chilled the skin of his tattooed arm. A short burst of automatic gunfire echoed in the distance, a common sound in the shattered seaside city. He studied the trash-strewn parking lot, flooded by the morning rain. A rusted, bullet-riddled car squatted on blown tires near the next building, home to an elderly woman even more desperate than he. A white Toyota Hilux sped in off the street. The 7.62mm machine gun mounted in back was crewed by a man in sunglasses and wearing a black-and-white keffiyeh wrapped around his face, just like the driver. The Hilux charged toward Clouzet's building, its knobby tires splashing away the cigarette butts and soda cans floating in the puddles. It skidded to a stop just below his balcony. His friend Tot, a fat, knife-scarred Hungarian, leaped out of the passenger seat, his boots splashing in the filthy water. His round, bearded face was uncovered for the Frenchman's benefit.
Clouzet! The blonde legionnaire stepped out of the shadows and onto the balcony. Tot, you old wolf, you came.
Of course. Why wouldn't I?
You risk a lot knowing me.
Clouzet's eyes drifted toward the man on the machine gun, staring at him behind his dark glasses. He hadn't moved.
We are all being hunted, my friend, Tot said. That is why we must stick together.
I need work. What do you have for me?
Tot planted his hands on his broad hips and shook his head, smiling.
Yes, you need work. But someone else, I'm afraid, must speak with you first.
Who?
Me, asshole. Clouzet spun on his heels, pulling his cig as he turned.
Jack's Glock fired first, putting two slugs into the bridge of Clouzet's nose, killing him instantly. Clouzet's SIG fired as his hand spasmed. The 9mm round plowed into the peeling paint of the moldy wall, just inches from Jack's head. Jack stepped over to the corpse and put two rounds in the blonde skull, then two more into the lifeless heart, shredding it. He stared at the ruined man, satisfied. Jack holstered his weapon and stepped over to the balcony, his eyes drawn to the wide horizon of the boundless sea. A wheeling gull cried in the distance. The man in the back pulled off his headgear. "All good, kid?" Clark asked, leaning on the machine gun. Jack nodded. "Yeah, all good." This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tom Clancy, Enemy Contact, by Mike Madden. This program was directed by Chris Kosheski, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2019 by the estate of Thomas L. Clancy Jr., Rubicon Inc., Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited, and Jack Ryan Limited Partnership. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.